The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm joined now by the manager for a winery in South Island, New Zealand that we absolutely loved called Bone Line. It is Fergus Winters. Fergus, thank you so much for doing the podcast today.
Not a problem.
Let's start here. We'll get to you in 1 second. But what do people need to know about Bone Line? And actually, why don't we start here? What do people need to know about North Canterbury, about the specific wine region you guys are located in?
Yeah, so we are roughly about an hour's drive north of Christchurch, more like 45 minutes, but you know, about an hour is a good time to drive. It's probably one of the most underrated regions in New Zealand. It's also one of the smallest. So we produce only about 3% of New Zealand's total wine. But with that, our aim is on quality rather than quantity. So it, as a region, it's still quite family-owned, most of the vineyards, even though that is changing, but still a lot of the vineyards are family-owned or small operator-owned. So the emphasis on quality is really, really important for us. With the climate, we're only about a mile or 2 kilometres, 2.5 kilometres away from the coast here, where we are anyway. So we get really big diurnal swings, so really hot during peak of the sunshine of the day, really cool evenings, which is perfect for growing world-class Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. In saying that, the region was probably originally founded in the mid-80s as a potential Riesling producing region. The problem with that is most, I guess, I wouldn't say uneducated, but most naive customers or like the general public really don't understand Riesling and assume all Rieslings are sweet, which is unfortunate because, including ourselves, North Canterbury makes some amazing dry Rieslings and a nice variety of different styles of Riesling as well. So it's a beautiful grape variety that's very underrated all around the world, I think, in my opinion. More people should drink Riesling. But they pivoted in, I would say, early to mid-90s to Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs, Pinot Noirs predominantly. So you'd have Pinot Noir as the biggest grape variety, and then it would be Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay would be kind of fighting for second or third, and Riesling would be in there as well. So they're the four main grape varieties. But Pinot Gris is substantial in the area too.
All right, bunch of things I want to go back to there.
Yep.
Do you think we'll ever get to a time where people won't fear Rieslings? And as I say all the time, there's nothing wrong with sugar as long as it's done correctly, or sweetness. And I would say that there's more residual sugar in a lot of mass-produced California wines than in an off-dry Riesling. But do you think we'll ever get to a time where people do not fear the Riesling?
I hope so. Like, it's slowly turning for us. Like, our largest growth in sales in the last 6 months would be dry Riesling, as we're talking about it, which has been amazing for us. And nice. It's a big surprise to us. Like, we're not surprised how good the wine is. We're just surprised how quickly our turnaround has been this year. The problem with Riesling is, I think, I don't know, it depends on generational thing. Like, where I grew up back home in Ireland, there was a lot of German wines like Black Tower, Blue Nun, really mass-produced styles of wine. Usually very sweet, not very interesting. And unfortunately, it got tied in with everyone assuming they were Rieslings because it was probably the one grape variety that they could pronounce from Germany, whereas most of those Blue Nun, Black Tower were generally Müller Thurgau and Liefermage and those kind of styles of wine. So I think that started the whole mental idea that all Rieslings are sweet. And I think it's just up to, well, I think it's mainly restaurants, to be honest. They're the ones who are going to have the first or the largest touch point, I guess, with customers, that they have confidence in themselves and their wine list that dry Riesling is such an underrated style of wine. Like, I always keep telling people here, if you're in doubt of what to serve with food, dry Riesling goes with everything. You know, it's one of those wines that can do red meat, white meat, fish, salads, even, you know, some sweet desserts as well. Like, I mean, if you're ever in doubt, get a beautiful fruit-forward style of dry Riesling and you cover most bases.
We'll get to Bone Line in a second, but yep. I want to now go back to you for a moment, Fergus. How did you first fall in love with wine?
So as I already alluded to, I'm Irish. So I was born in the 1980s in Ireland. Grew up in a family-owned bar, public house. And I was quite lucky, like at the time, not that I knew anything about it, but in the 80s, 90s, my parents always had Burgundies and Bordeaux varietals and like Pinots and Chardonnays and blends, Southern Rhone blends as well, like Châteauneuf-du-Pape and stuff like that. Not that I knew anything about wine, but they always had really good wine around. And it kind of sparked interest a little bit. I didn't really know, like, Nuits Saint-Georges was a Pinot Noir or any of that kind of stuff, or Chablis was Chardonnay. But as I grew up in the pub, I guess serving basic wine was a thing. But then I made a decision in my teenage years to become a chef. So I started my chef training at 17 and ended up in and around the being a chef for about 17 years after that. So obviously with that, wine has to come into my orbit a bit more, I guess. So I did take a couple of a few early WSET courses back in Ireland, WSET courses back in Ireland, just to try and understand kind of basics a little bit. And then when I finally started to realize that, even though it is the same grape and the same producer, unlike a beer or spirits, every year can be different, or even every parcel of land could be different. And it's like, ooh, it's just like, it's that generic thing that every bottle tells a story, but it's genuinely true. For like the better producers, I mean, I know the larger mass-produced wines can be quite generic, but for those interesting wines, it really is an absolute capture of a season. And being able to look at a wine and say, "Oh, that was a warm vintage," or "That was a cool vintage," or difficult just by smell and taste is like it's kind of the purest capturing of a craft beverage, I guess you can find. So that's what captivated me, to be honest. And then I moved to New Zealand in 2013, originally just for a year, just to get away from Ireland, because we were still recovering from the 08 crash, I guess. Like, as I said, I was working as a chef back then, but I was kind of tired of working, 60, 70, 80 hours a week for 300, €400 a week and being made feel I should be grateful to have a job. So I said, look, I'll go away for a year, chill, reset. Flew into Christchurch, which is 2 years after the earthquake, keep in mind. So the earthquakes here were in 2011. So I came here in 2013. So things weren't exactly shiny and new yet. It was still quite a mess. But work was easy as a chef still. So I was working around different restaurants. But there was a vibe in the city that was really, really, I mean, you either got it or you didn't. There was a lot of people I met at the same time who just thought the place was in ruin and just didn't get it. But for me, there was a vibe, there was a feeling, there was just something about the place. And then I got to a stage where my visa eventually became residency. So then I was like, well, I'm kind of tired of being a chef, but I like wine. New Zealand makes wine. There's a little wine region about an hour north of here. I'll go explore there. So in 2017, I applied and took over the cellar door manager job at another winery here in Waiperä called Greystone Wines, which was a great experience for me. I was there for about 5.5 years. We expanded from a small tasting room into a restaurant by the time I left in those 5.5 years through COVID as well. So that was a bit difficult, but it was really, really, really good from a personal growth as well, just to look at what we can do and what's achievable if we want to work hard. And then during all that as well, I also had the opportunity to go back to Lincoln University and study postgraduate in winemaking. So that was in 2021, which is a 1 year course in winemaking. So I did that, which is great. And that led on to entering Lincoln University's master's program. So I now have a master's of winemaking and viticulture as well, which I finished last year. So it's been a really big change in my life in some ways, but it's still, again, I guess it's based around hospitality, even though I'm more in sales now. But wine is one of these things that brings people together, and that's what you want. You want it to be an experience that even if you bring a great bottle of wine to something, it's about getting the people there rather than the wine dominating in a lot of ways. You want it to be part of the conversation and not just be the total subject of the conversation might be. So that's, in a nutshell, that's kind of my where I am now, I guess.
It's interesting. One thing I never thought of before is that anything in sales, it's always going to be a level of transaction and it's two very different parties, one trying to sell and the other debating whether or not to buy it. But when it comes to wine does seem to be more unique. It does seem to be, it is much more personal. I think it's more friendly Like when you, if someone's working in a winery, you want to sell your Riesling and Pinot because you still got bills to pay. But it just feels like a completely different environment than if you go in to buy a car or furniture or even produce. Like, I think maybe part of it is there's just so much more storytelling that goes with wine than there does with so many other products.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it depends on which or what size of winery you go to. Like, you can go to the larger brands and the larger vineyards that are, I mean, they're really nice to make really good wine, and their staff are really professional, and everything looks really amazing. And but it can also it can look too pristine at the same time, in my opinion. It can be too professional and too almost lacks a little bit of soul. You know, for me, I'd rather go to a smaller family-owned winery or a smaller, a smaller entity and go in and kind of meet the people who are like, as from your visit here, like you got a chance to talk to myself. You met Willie the winemaker, you met Jaden who helps out, there's a lot of things you're close to the people who are involved in the winemaking. And for us, we don't just want you to love the wine, we want you to love the place. So, like my philosophy has always been since I've been running cellar doors or teaching staff about cellar doors, is there's only three important things about wine to the customer, not to ourselves, but the customer. Well, the first one is, do they like it? Yes or no? So you have a range of wines, and you can't cater for everyone's taste. That's just impossible. If you did, life would be boring. Wines would be very generic, very boring. So first question you ask them, do they like it? Yes or no? If they do, great. Have a wee chat about that. Move on. You kind of get a vibe of what they like, what they don't like. If they don't like it, you can again talk about it and say, well, why don't you like it? Is it too sweet, or is it too acidic, or is it too fruity? And the customer themselves might know what they like and don't like, but they just know that they don't like it. So it's up to you then to kind of help them figure out what they do like. So then you go through the rest of the tasting. The second thing for me is would they buy a bottle? So if they buy a bottle, it means they've had a really good experience. They've found something that they like. They've had a good time. They're willing to invest their money, take it home, and enjoy it again. Say, oh, do you remember that day at the Bone Line? It was great. The sun was out. The dogs were there. Oh, it was so good. And the third thing for me is a second bottle of wine. Now, that second bottle of wine could come 6 months to a year later. They're at a restaurant. They're at a wine shop somewhere. And they go, oh, I remember that. That was a great day. The wines are amazing. They're like, we never heard of them before, but we went there. We had the story. We met the guys. We met the dogs. It was so good. And we're going to, Christine's birthday tonight. Let's bring something nice that we know this is really good. So they've kind of bought into your brand. They've bought into your I guess your ethos and what you're actually thinking, and they become brand ambassadors without even knowing it. And that's really important for us, is that it's that third one, that second bottle of wine, which is at a later stage, that wine is not, I mean, there are lower tiered wines, but for us it's you could almost class it as a luxury in a sense, because anything above $25, $30, you kind of have to think, is it worth, especially now with fuel prices, is it something we can afford? Is it something we can do? But when you want them to invest that $20, $30, $40, $50 into a bottle of wine, you want them to get like $80, $90, $100, $120 worth of enjoyment back, because they've brought an element of either fun or excitement, or just something that's really worth and talking about and tangible to a conversation. So we take that very, very seriously for ourselves.
Kind of interesting that I never, another thing I never really thought of, because I work in sports and you become a fan of a team. Your father, your mother got you a fan of a favorite team when you were a kid. They won a playoff game. Now you're hooked. Now you feel a sense of ownership of the team. You feel a connection. There's kind of that same thing with wine. If you have a good experience and you get to meet the winemaker or the owner, and you're petting the dog and the wine is great, and then you buy that second bottle at dinner and it pairs perfectly with lamb, now you're a fan and you're going to buy it in the future, but also you're going to be rooting for the winery. You're going to be hoping the winery does well for years and years on end, because now you feel a connection to it and it's a wine you can go back to over and over.
Yeah, I mean, it's about a personal thing, but it's also about a personal connection. Like, we just want people to come and have a good time and just enjoy themselves. Like, we don't take ourselves seriously, but we take our wines quite seriously. We're definitely not ones to be wearing shirts and long pants and aprons and servicing and giving you a script. Like, as you know from your tasting here, like I my ethos is pour the wine and let the wine speak. So I'm not going to tell you it's going to have hints of rosemary and thyme and bay leaf and, you know, whatever. I'm not going to bring you down a garden path, which I could easily do.
Yeah.
I choose not to. And I mean, it does help being Irish in New Zealand that I get away with a lot more than other people do. But I mean, I could lead you down a pathway and, you know, and convince you you had a great experience. And then you go home and taste the wine and go, like, actually, I don't even really like this. It's not, you know, and that's not what we want. We want them to absolutely be captivated by the first sip. And then we'll talk about it. And then we'll say why we've done this or why we've chosen to do the things that we do. You know, it has to be that the wine has to speak for itself on its own. Because at the end of the day, if they pick it up off a shelf in a liquor store, a wine store, or at a restaurant, pick it off a list, we're not there to do that. So it has to speak to them very, very quickly from the glass by itself.
Yeah, well, when we met you, you weren't even there originally talking with us. It was someone else. And then I think you were making coffee for other people. And
yeah.
Then you came in, and then we all started yammering. Well, let's talk a little bit about the wines of Boneline.
Yep.
And don't ignore the Cab Franc, which was damn good.
Just sold out of the Cab Franc. Yeah, look, you reminded
Congrats.
Me.
Good job.
Yeah, so the vineyard here, as I said, we're about a 45-minute drive north of Christchurch. We are about another 8 or 9 minutes off the main highway. So we do suffer a little bit of notoriety that we're not on the main drive. But if you search us out, or thankfully we have got really good relationships with a lot of the other wineries, that if they ask for somewhere else to go, they seem to love us. So it's great that other wine staff in the area send people our way. But we're nestled on the south bank of the Waipara River, which is the name of the river that gives the whole area or the sub-region where we are. So we're actually technically in Waipara, which is the sub-region of North Canterbury. The vineyard that we are on has three terraces, so it's quite distinct terraces. So if you're driving along the main road, that's our top terrace. When you come into the vineyard, you actually drop down a level, and that's our mid-terrace, and then we have a lower terrace down by the river. And we're facing, our aspect is east to west, so we have a lot of sunshine during the day. But our vineyard is on the south side, but it's, you know, orientated east to west. We were bought, the vineyard was bought in 89 by the Tutton and Hill family, who are still the owners today at the moment. They were driving around Waipara in 88, I think it was, looking for somewhere to potentially grow grapes because they thought, you know, this could be a really good region to grow grapes. Came across this site here, and it wasn't for sale then. It was a sheep station, so a sheep farm here. So, but this would be perfect. It's got the terraces, it's got lovely aspect. So this is kind of what we need. So about a year later, they actually found out that the site came up for sale, the exact site that they saw, which was really cool. So they went and bought that. And then during the due diligence of all the purchasing of the vineyard, they actually found out that it was in their family, I think a couple of generations before, I'm pretty sure. So it was in the family previously. It had been sold to a couple of other people in between and then came back into the family, which was,
really?
Yeah, it's one of those kind of really cool little, you know, amazing things that just happen, unbeknownst, but just happened. So they started planting in 89-90, so most of the plantings went in 90-91. The vineyard terraces that we have been carved out by both glacial and river erosion, so it's very hard to describe unless you're here. You've seen it, obviously, but with the terraces, our topsoil is basically a dumping of the waste from those glaciers and those rivers. So a lot of vineyards will say we have amazing limestone everywhere, or we have gravel, or we have everything. And they are amazing soils, but our soils are so varied. It makes it really interesting for us, but very hard to explain to a lot of people. Like, we have variances of 5 to 10 days in ripening in some sections of the same vineyard due to those little soil differences, which is really nice because it gives us a nice variation that we can have some grapes with Pinot Noir, say, that are slightly more acidic and give a bit of brightness to the wine, and some of them maybe at peak ripeness, so they're more fruit driven. So by picking them all together and fermenting them, it just makes a really, really nice blend at the end. With the elevation difference from our bottom terrace to our top terrace in summertime, if it's 31, 32 degrees Celsius around the cellar door or the top terrace, it can be 38, 39, 40 down our bottom terrace. So it's a really nice Big difference. Now, we wouldn't get those days too often, but you might get a few of them a year. But with the bottom terrace having massive retaining walls at the back, they absorb a lot of heat during those days, and then it radiates back into the vineyard, and it extends our growing season. So that's why we're kind of an exception to the rule in the area that we have some Cabernet varietals, or Bordeaux varietals, I should say. So we have Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, and a little bit of Merlot. So having that long extended growing season into autumn really, really helps with ripening those wines. So we make, given the year, we make 7, 8 wines, sometimes 9. So we generally make a Sauvignon Blanc, which is, in past, we've made 2 styles of Sauvignon Blanc. We make one that is our interpretation of a classic New Zealand style Sauv. So it's stainless steel fermented, nice and cool. But because we get a lot of sunshine and a lot of UV light here, we get a really rich, fruit-forward style of Sauvignon Blanc. We make a second style, sometimes called Riverbone, which is an oak barrel fermented style. No new oak, all neutral oak, wild ferment, just really kind of textural and bodied style Sauvignon Blanc. You'd almost think it was in that kind of Chardonnay kind of vibe, but it's still a Sauvignon Blanc. Make 2 styles of Chardonnay in certain vintages. We make one called Sharkstone, which is an oak fermented style Chardonnay. So usually around 20% new French oak, wild ferment, and never usually full Malo, but some years we do full Malo conversion if we think it's right. But sometimes we like to leave a little bit of malic acid on the back palate just to give it a bit of brightness. We make another Chardonnay called Barebone, which is, I guess, an interpretation of Chablis style. So no new oak on it. So it's about crispness, vibrancy, brightness, and a lot of real mineral drive to it. Beautiful and underrated style of Chardonnay, if you ask me. 2 styles of Riesling, a dry Riesling, as I've already said, which, you know, Riesling is, as it will go back to, it's one of these grapes that, even when you do your education in wine, it's one of these ones that breaks all the rules. Like, and numbers lie in Riesling. And what I mean by that is, you might say, oh, how many grams of residual sugar has it got? And it could be 12 to 13. And you're like, ooh, that's high. But high in balance in a Riesling with acidity could be still a dry wine. So Riesling is very misunderstood because I think a lot of people base it on numbers, where instead of actually basing it on the wine itself, because unless you have all the tech details like TA and acidity and pH and stuff. If you're looking at just grams of sugar, it's one of these things that can be very misleading in a lot of ways. But our dry Riesling comes in about 5, 6, 7 grams of residual sugar, depending on the vintage. We then make an off dry style, or I'm sorry, medium dry style called Hellblock, which comes in around 25, 26, 27 grams residual, depending on the vintage. Again, with that one on the back palate, there's a lovely brightness of acidity. So even though it is fruit forward and generous on the front palate, there's always that lovely drying acidity that comes in and just cleans out your palate. And for me, North Canterbury Rieslings in general, the acidic structure of all the Rieslings, it has an oily, zesty, limey, lime cordial kind of vibe to them. And it's pretty dominant in most Rieslings in the region that you get this oily, lovely, luscious brightness, and it's like, oh, that has to be like, you know, North Canterbury style Riesling because it has that lime zest brightness to it. And then we make a rosé called Pink Noise. So our Pink Noise rosé, we're kind of different in a lot of ways that we'll pick grapes specifically for rosé. Like, we're not looking at it as a secondary wine. We're looking at what's really good that year, what looks tasty. We also look at weather patterns. So for 2025, we had some Cabernet Sauvignon still hanging out, and there was a rain event coming through that we didn't think would do the Cabernet Sauvignon any favors to make it into our blend. So we said, right, it's looking really good now. Let's just make a really, really kick-ass rosé. So we brought that in earlier. We'd rather make something amazing than something average, you know? So generally, our rosés will have a bit of Pinot Noir, a little bit of the Cabernets in it, and possibly a tiny bit of Merlot. And sometimes with the Merlot, we'll do a barrel ferment for that. No new oak, just to give it a roundness and kind of mid-palate warmth. And we do Pinot Noir, which is the region's known for, as I said. So sometimes, again, we make 2 styles of Pinot. Pinot is definitely the one for me that we look at as interpreting the season a lot. So I look at Pinot Noir kind of like a cover song. It's like, you know, it's Pinot, but it's how you interpret
Right. That's a
it.
good analogy. I
So
haven't heard that before.
for us, like, we do two styles. We do one called Waiti and one called Waimannu. So Waiti is generally a higher percentage of whole bunch, a bit more, maybe a little bit of carbonic maceration. It's crunchy, it's vibrant, it's youthful. It's never going to be that powerful, but it's definitely bright and enthusiastic and youthful and fresh. Whereas Waimannu is a bit more classical. It's got some new oak on it. It's warmer, definitely more fruit driven, bigger. So yeah, we just look at it as our interpretation of that fruit and that vintage, especially for them. And then we have our Bordeaux program. I'll move on to that quickly. So we do, in really good years, we'll make a single varietal Cabernet Franc, which I think you tried. We had the 2020 Amphitheatre Cabernet Franc. Beautiful. Cabernet Franc is one of these grapes that gets a lot of flack, and it shouldn't. Again, you know, I think it's always been just used as a filler in Bordeaux, as kind of an afterthought that we need. I think when where they're growing it, they're not looking after it as well as they should, because it don't, in my opinion, it only has this little window where it's like it's quite green here, and then it's ripe, beautiful, beautiful, flabby. You know, the acidity drops out of it. It's just a fruit bomb. It's just there to
Yeah.
fill things in. We're lucky with the long ripening of autumn here that we get it most of the time past that greeny, stalky, methoxypyrazine-y kind of greenness to it. And we get that lovely red fruit drive. And then as it ages, it gets lovely dry herbs and that pencil shaving distinct. I don't know if the young people understand what pencil shavings are, but when I went to school, we had to pair a pencil, you know, shave a pencil. And it's that distinct smell, you know. It's kind of like wood and carbon. And it's just, yeah, it's nostalgic. But to me, that's Cab Franc in a nutshell. And it's beautiful. And we're lucky that we can make a single varietal of it. And then our flagship wine, I guess, or what we're best known for, is what we call Iridium. That's our Bordeaux blend of Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, which is beautiful. Hope that covers everything.
Yeah, no, it's and listen, yeah, I love that Cab Franc. I'm glad it's sold out. And you're right, young people will not know what pencil shavings is. I haven't thought of that before because I don't know the last time anyone under the age of 35 ever had to sharpen a pencil. And I just thought about this about Cab Franc. Cab Franc is the avocado of the wine world. There's just such a thin period of time when it's properly ready. And if you're too early or too late, you're fucked. But when you get it in the middle, it's awesome.
And again, it's like it gets dominated by, oh, especially when you suppose you're looking in the States and that, like, Napa Cab. It's straight away, it's Cabernet Sauvignon. There's no mention of Cabernet Franc, you know. Or it's Merlot, and I know Merlot got an ass kicking from Sideways, but, like, you know, it's those two are the big, you know, I mean, even larger structured wines like Malbec and all that aren't as well known. You know, it's in America, I'm sure, and States in general, it'd be more Cab Sav than Merlot. So Cab Franc's not going to get a look in. And, like, even in France, it's not that common. But we look at Cab Franc as well as something special, because in 2021 vintage, for anyone who's listening doesn't understand, we've got different seasons down here in New Zealand. So our springtime for the harvest of 2021 is actually October 2020. But in October 2020, we had a severe frost here, and we lost about 55, 60% of the vineyard in one night. It was just horrendous. Our Cabernets fought through with secondary growth. So most vines will establish buds that are called secondary buds. And if your primary ones are damaged, like in frost, they will actually continue to grow with these secondary buds. Generally, secondary fruit from these buds is never as good, but it's good to get something. So in 2021, we looked at it and said, right, what's the Cabernet Franc like from the secondary growth buds? Says it's a bit lighter, it's a bit more, you know, it's not as powerful as our other one. So we picked it anyway, and we had enough fruit to make about 390 bottles. So we made a 2021 Cab Franc. But because it's a lighter style, we changed the bottle shape. So normally our Cab Franc, our amphitheater, would be in a Bordeaux bottle, that's the one with the high shoulders. We chose to put it into a Loire style bottle because Loire Cab Francs are a bit more elegant, a bit more feminine, I guess, in some ways, and not as powerful as Bordeaux's. So we wanted to make that distinction that we've actually thought about this, that if you love the Cabernet Franc in the past, this is Cab Franc, but it's not the same. So we're very conscious about those kind of decisions as well.
That's smart. Yeah, that's smart. But before I let you go, what do you, and by the way, Cab Franc is big here in Ontario. In Niagara,
yeah.
single vineyard or 100% Cab Franc is a big thing. I'm wondering, you got, as you said earlier, you got your master's degree, and I'm wondering, do you have any plans to, on the side, be making some of, you know, your own wine, Domaine de Fergus, while still working for Bone Line?
I do have my own wine label. It's very small at the minute. So it was established with three other guys I went to uni with, first of all. So in 2021, there was a group of, because it was after COVID, there was not a lot to do. So it was a lot of mature students that year. So the mature students kind of hung out together. And, you know, it's kind of weird if you're in your mid to late 30s hanging out with 19-year-olds. So if you're hanging out with people at similar of age, it's a bit more palatable. But we all became really good friends. And I kind of said, hey, let's just do one ton of Pinot Noir. Well, actually, the idea was, because there's four of us, we decided to call it Quadrant, because there's four of us. And the long-term plan is to make four wines from every vintage in a style that reflects somebody in the group. So I'm Pinot Noir because, for me, Pinot, if you can make a really good Pinot Noir, you can make really good anything. I think it's one of those grapes that's very hard to get right and so easy to make shit out of. So I take Pinot very seriously when it comes to that. So so we called it the Pinot 0.5. So 0.5 because it's half of a quadrant, and we only use Clone 5. So that was the Pinot. We've made one in 2023 and we've made one in 2025. And we're working, but life goes on as well. So one of the guys, Amanda, she just had a baby last year. So she's kind of taking a sidestep. The other guys have bought houses and stuff. So, you know, life gets in the way. But we're pushing on, hopefully. So the idea is to make the 0.5 Pinot, which we make. We're going to make the 0.25 Chardonnay, which is around about 25% New French Oak is the style that we're looking at. 0.75 blend, because it's a 750 bottle and there's three components to a blend. So 0.75 is 3/4. And then the one Riesling. So all of them add together are quadrants, or four parts of the same thing, is the kind of vibe. Yeah. It's expensive. Winemaking is not a very low maintenance hobby, but it's fun.
Oh yeah, and the profit margins are so slim. I say that to everyone.
Profit?
Yeah.
What's profit?
I heard about it. It's a myth. It's like a unicorn.
Yeah, it's a mythical thing.
Yeah. Fergus, I really appreciate you being on. I think message I want to get out to anyone, if anyone is traveling to South Island, New Zealand. I mean, obviously, and you love wine, obviously check out Otago, check out Nelson, but do not forget about North Canterbury, not that far from Christchurch. You guys make fantastic wines. There's a bunch of small vineyards, not that far. It's easy to get to them. We had a great time and we love meeting all you guys. Love the vibe.
Oh, thanks. Well, if anyone comes to the area, just let us know from the podcast or whatever. But check us out. There's thebonline.co.nz. There's northcanterbywines.co.nz. That's the regional website, which give you a good insight into what's here, what's available in the area. There's plenty of Airbnbs around. There's a little town called Amberley that has a little brew pub. So we have a lot of things you can do in the area. I would suggest maybe come in early March and you can get the wine festival here, because we have a wine festival in Waipara itself. It's in it's a little oak wood tree domain, which is kind of cool. So you're under the oak trees and you get to see all the wineries, and it's a cool little vibe. Only about 4,000 people, so it's not a massive event. But definitely come to see North Canterbury for sure.
Yeah, in March, that's when we were there. Perfect time. Not crazy busy, but more than warm enough. Fergus, thank you so much for coming.
Pleasure.
On. It's a great story. Really appreciate.
Anytime. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.